I continue to enjoy the music, even the song selection. Holy, holy, holy. I don't even know how old that is. I'd have to look in a hymnal. I saw on the screen that this last hymn was written in 1863. And then sandwiched in between that is what is becoming one of my favorite songs of all, and that is Only a Holy God. Which is what we do. We come here to worship the Holy God this morning. I hope that was your intention on coming here. I would encourage you to listen to some more of that group's music. They're called City Alight. You can find them on any streaming service. If you walk into my office before church on Sundays, that's usually what's playing. It just helps me to remember why we're here. This morning we're going to continue in Psalms, as you heard Shane read, Psalm 55. If you have your Bible, you can turn to that. That's what we'll be referring to, as again, we take kind of an overview of this Psalm. It's amazing, well, maybe not amazing, it's just that we're just now realizing, for some of us, how each of the Psalms we've looked at deals with someone who's struggling with an issue in their life, and they start out frustrated or angry or scared. And then we watch through the psalm the process to trusting in God to handle the situation. We looked at Psalm 13. Remember, it was, "How long, O Lord, are you going to be silent? Why are you hiding your face from me?" The psalmist was dismayed. We went from there to Psalm 23 and talked about the dark valleys of life, how we can trust our shepherd through those. We moved to Psalms 42 and 43 and dealt with discouragement. Last week, we looked at Psalm 51, very familiar psalm, as we dealt with our own sin, and even to the point of actually calling it our sin and taking responsibility for it and realizing the ugliness of it before God. This week, Psalm 55... the main problem we're looking at is betrayal, if you will, betrayal by a close friend. But there's a lot of themes that run through this psalm, and we're going to cover some of those this morning. What struck me the first time I read this is verses 6, 7, and 8. The whole concept of escape. Just get me out of here. It says, "And I say, oh, that I had wings like a dove, I would fly away and be at rest. Yes, I would wander far away. I would lodge in the wilderness. I would hurry to find a shelter from the raging wind and tempest." I just want to get away. All that's going on in my life now is too much to deal with. I need to escape. And I wonder how many of you deal with that. Tomorrow's Monday morning, everyone's favorite day and favorite time of the week. You return to a job or a classroom or whatever it may be. And I wonder what it is you would like to escape from. Could be someone you're meeting that you dread. Or maybe it's another day not being near someone that you would like to be near. And for you, the psalm is not a beautiful aria written to encourage, but it's just a reminder of what your life is like. I just want out. Cannot handle the problems. I remember when I think of escape and taking me away from this, I don't know why this came to my mind so quickly. It's probably revealed something very disturbing about me. I remember from the 1970s, a television commercial for Calgon bubble bath. Does anyone remember that? Okay, good. So I'm not the only weirdo in the room. But you see a lady, and she's just dressed beyond measure. This was a lady's product. This was before men's cosmetics and beauty things came along. The only thing they marketed to men was lava soap, which, you know, got your hands clean because it took off that top layer of skin where the dirt was. But Calgon was a bubble bath marketed to ladies, and this lady was very frustrated in the opening scenes. You can probably Google and find the commercials. They have everything now is saved somewhere online. But she complains about the traffic and her boss and the baby and the dog. And then she just, in all of her frustration, just screams out, "Calgon, take me away." And the next scene, you see her in a huge bubble bath the size of half of this stage, up to her neck in bubbles. and just at ease with the world. And the tagline for the commercial is, lose yourself in luxury. I've never really defined luxury as a nice bubble bath, but I guess in the 1970s, that's what people longed for. So sometimes we just want to yell, take me away. The situation I'm in, I'd rather just avoid. It could be almost anything, but in our hearts we know, and I don't know why, but we just do, that just running is not really escape. Psalm 55 was written to help you. According to the title of the psalm, we see that it's a maskil of David. And we don't know the exact definition of the word maskil, but it comes from a root which means to instruct. And so I think we can safely assume that David wrote this psalm to instruct or assist those of you and me who deal with issues like this. I mean, I wish we had time to read the whole thing again and then to read it again, because it's more than just a cry for help. I love the way it ends. The very last phrase of the very last verse says, but I will trust in you. And I think that trust and security and peace are those things we long for in whatever situation we're in. That's what he wanted. That's what we want. So the psalm really breaks itself down into three basic components. And this outline has been preached by many people. I think it originated with the late G. Campbell Morgan as he wrote this out. But there's three parts to this psalm that I want you to note. And the first, I'll just go ahead and give you the outline now and then we'll go through it. Verses 1 through 8 deal with David's fear. David's fear. It's really a prayer of distress. And then secondly, in verses 9 through 15, we see David's fury. It is really a prayer for justice. And then finally, in verses 16 through 23, which is the end of the chapter, we see David's faith. It is a prayer of assurance. So David's fear, David's fury, and David's faith. So let's start at the beginning. That's one of the best places to start and deal with David's fear in the first 8 verses. You see, David has some deep personal problems as we unpack this psalm. He's distressed. He's living in a situation that really makes matters worse. You read in verse 11, the NIV phrases it this way, destructive forces are at work in the city. Crime statistics seem to have risen. Verses 9 says there's violence and strife. But there's also personal relationship issues. There's iniquity and trouble within the city. That's in verse 10. On the one hand, there's oppression. And on the other hand, there's fraud. That's in verse 11. It's all too common a scene, I think, because there is a connection between our spiritual and mental well-being and our environment. It's very complex. We're not going to get into that because I don't have all of the details of that. It's very psychological, and we're not going to teach psychology in here. All I can say is the environment David is in seems to have increased his anxiety and his distress and even maybe his depression rather than helping it. Most of us know exactly what David is talking about when he describes this city. Many today consider big cities today to have the same exact problems. You've heard of urban flight, people leaving the city to get away from these kind of issues. Destructive forces, violence, strife, iniquity, trouble, oppression, fraud. Move to the suburbs where there's just oppression light. Violence and strife light. Same problems, just different setting. But David here really isn't providing us with a sociological analysis of cities. I think he's pointing out the fact that there are forces that are let loose in the city that fight against his spiritual well-being. And so I think it's safe for us to say that there are same type forces at work today in the settings in which we live that fight against our spiritual well-being. The name of the city isn't mentioned in the psalm, but I think most readers, most of the original readers would assume that to be Jerusalem, the city of God. That's where these destructive forces had been released, among the people of God. Violence, strife, iniquity, verses 9 and 10, within the fellowship of God's people. No wonder David was distressed or even depressed. It's bad enough to experience alienation out in the world, but when those kind of problems come within God's people, that's even more depressing. But there's worse things to come. I mean, we can cope with the people we know to be our enemies. It says here that David has been opposed by someone he counted among his close friends. This is where the betrayal is mentioned. Let's skip around to see this in verses 20 and 21. He refers to this person as his companion. My companion stretched out his hand against his friends. He violated his covenant. Listen to this description of his speech. His speech was smooth as butter, yet war was in his heart. His words were softer than oil, yet they were drawn swords. He had been betrayed by someone he trusted. So David is angry. Of course he's angry. You would be too. We don't know the details of his disappointment. He doesn't really go into a lot here. And probably that's because this is a masculine, and he wants you to be able to apply it to whatever situation you're in. It can be applicable to many situations. It could be a business relationship where someone has betrayed you. It describes almost this description here. It could talk about the beginnings of a church split, strife within God's family. It can also be applied to the breakup of a marriage. So these words that describe this kind of betrayal can be applied to many different circumstances. I mean, listen to verses 12 through 14. For it is not an enemy who taunts me, then I could bear it. It is not an adversary who deals insolently with me, then I could hide from him. But it is you, a man, my equal, my companion, my familiar friend. We used to take sweet counsel together within God's house. We walked in the throng. It's likely, even though David doesn't mention it here, it's likely that the person he's talking about is one of his personal counselors. His name was Ahithophel. In 2 Samuel 15, you read about the revolt and the attempted coup of David's son Absalom. And Ahithophel was one that went along with Absalom. And there's a prayer in 2 Samuel 15 that we'll get to in a moment. It's in verse 31, which sounds very similar to part of the prayer that David prays here. So that similarity leads us to believe that the person he's talking about that betrayed him was this trusted counselor, Ahithophel. So, trusted advisor. A close friend has betrayed him. So I would ask you, have you ever been slandered or betrayed by a friend? By someone you trusted? It hurts, doesn't it? How many of you have written long emails with things you would never say out loud face to face, responding to an accusation or a slandering statement or betrayal? And then deleted it. Am I the only one that does that? Usually I'll send those kind of emails to my wife and hope that she'll tell me to delete it, which she usually does. But we just want to set the record straight. We want this person to know that what you said or what you did is wrong and it's untrue and it's ungodly, and may curses come upon your head and your offspring's heads. You may crabgrass infest your yard. Just whatever you think of at the moment, you write it all out. So how would you respond when someone betrays you and slanders you maybe? Especially someone you trusted. In David's case, this betrayal was coupled with the hostility of real enemies. In verses 2 and 3, it says, I am restless in my complaint and I moan because of the noise of the enemy, because of the oppression of the wicked. No wonder he cries out in verse 4, my heart is in anguish within me. The terrors of death have fallen upon me. Fear and trembling come upon me, and horror overwhelms me. Now that kind of language, that's pretty strong. I don't know how you could talk about being more unsettled and afraid and anxious and distressed than those words. This is David, the king. Terrors of death have fallen over me. Fallen upon me. Fear and trembling come upon me, and horror overwhelms me. His whole life now is a catalog as he just looks through it of disappointment, opposition. He feels overwhelmed. So what is he to do? Well, that leads us to verse 6. This is what he wants to do. And I say, oh, that I had wings like a dove and I could fly away and be at rest. Yes, I would wander far away and I would lodge in the wilderness. I would hurry to find a shelter from the raging wind and tempest. I mean, if David was in a bubble bath right now, he would say, Calgon, take me away. And we see he says, oh, that I had wings like a dove. The dove in that day was recognized as the fastest of the smaller birds. And if you don't believe it, I remember going dove hunting here when the wind's blowing like 20 miles an hour out of the south. And that's, of course, the direction the dove decides to fly. So it's got to be going 150 miles an hour as it flies by. And by the time I get my gun up, it's gone. They're fast. Not like the big fat doves that live in your backyard that are easy. These little things were fast. And so I understand that. If I could just get out of here as quickly as possible, the wings of a dove. We've all said it in our own way. Our own resources are inadequate to meet the situation. It's simply too hopeless. So flight is our only option. It's our only hope. If only we had the wings of a dove and could get out of here. And that takes a different shape for many of us today. So how do you escape? Some people escape into work, others into leisure, some in pleasure. Some live in the past, even with its sorrows and successes. Others plan for the future. Some escape into lethargy and some into overactivity. There's all kinds of escape mechanisms that we will use to avoid the issue that's facing us. Some of these habits, escape actions, will bring ruin to marriages, to homes and families, even their own bodies. But church, you guys know that flight can never be a solution. That's why it's called escape. It's not a solution. The situation remains unchanged, and actually, if the truth were to be told, we become less able to cope with it. And we looked last week in Psalm 51 that says in verse 6 that God desires truth or reality in the inner being. So we've got to face reality. We've got to be real as we deal with these issues and not just run. Now I think David hasn't even realized that as he's going through this, he's actually praying to God. He's praying about his situation. Even when he says he wishes he had the wings of a dove, he's still saying that in the presence of God. And I think here really lies the secret to David's stability in the face of what's going on in the city. It says that he calls to God evening and morning and at noon. That's in verse 17. Now for the Jew, the new day began at sundown. That's why we see that order of times listed in that verse, from evening in morning and at noon. Now, if you and I were writing this today, we would say, we call out to God morning, noon, and night, because that's how we measure a day. Maybe David is just saying that we have to be steadfast in prayer. Maybe. It seems likely, however, to me, that just like Daniel, in Daniel chapter 6, he had a regular discipline of prayer, maybe a time of reflection or meditation upon God and his character. What old-timers like me used to call a quiet time. And I think these times that he spent in prayer were really his salvation during this stressful time for several reasons. When we feel overwhelmed by circumstances, our whole life begins to be disordered. Things don't work in our life the way they used to, and we'll sometimes neglect some of the most basic things we're to do. And I think David was able to keep a fixed point in his life of prayer to God three times a day. When everything else seemed to collapse, this basic structure was left. And I think it allowed recovery and rebuilding. So I would just challenge you that when things become overwhelming like that, to keep up your basic disciplines and your duties. We can't let them collapse, because then our defenses are broken down and rebuilding will be slow, if not impossible. So maintain that time of going to God in prayer, even during the times where you complain about all the evil and iniquity and strife and fraud around you. And I will tell you this, sometimes it's too late to think about that when you're in the situation. We need to build those habits now. We need to develop those disciplines of prayer and reflection upon God now. But there's another reason why I think this is so important and was important in helping David, and that is serious thought about God. When we move our focus from the situation unto God, it really steadies us. I mean, you've seen before people who are in incredible, difficult situations, whether it be financial or health, or whatever the case may be, and they're just a rock. Nothing phases them. I don't mean they're stoic. I mean they're confident. They're confident in their Lord. Thinking and meditating and praying to God will steady you. It elevates your thoughts above the situation. You know, sometimes I think rather than the wings of a dove to fly out of here, maybe we need to go to Isaiah chapter 40, verse 31, and think about the wings like eagles, where we can soar above the problem. Those are the wings I would rather have than the wings of the dove. It convinces us that it is not our circumstances, but it is our God who is sovereign. And then we're able to see our situations in their true light. David gives us an example. He prayed for these things, I believe, on a daily basis. And as we read through the psalm, we kind of see that the darkness fades and a new light seems to come in to his situation. In verse 16, it says, "But I call to God and the Lord will save me." Verse 17, "He hears my voice." Verse 18, "He redeems my soul in safety." Verse 19, "God who is enthroned from of old." So in the middle of this disaster, I think it's like the clouds were just parted for him, and he sees that God reigns and God saves. I think these are the two most basic doctrines of Scripture. God reigns, God saves. And I think they're two of the most practical truths that we can learn and apply. And I think this comes from meeting with God three times a day. You can see the same thing in the life of Daniel. If you were here when Thomas went through Daniel, you remember his times of prayer three times a day as well. And I can see him writing this same lament. "Evening and morning and at noon, I utter my complaint and moan, and he hears my voice and he redeems my soul in safety." That's Daniel chapter 6. It's also Psalm 55, 17 and 18. You can look to Daniel's companions, threatened with the burning furnace They remained faithful to God. But that faithfulness to God was rooted in the revelation of God in Scripture. And Isaiah 43:2 says, "When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. And through the rivers, they shall not overwhelm you. When you walk through fire, you shall not be burned, and the flame shall not consume you." And then in Daniel 3, we read, "If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." In either event, they committed to follow their God, the same God we read in Romans, who works for the good of all those who love him and have been called according to his purpose. Sadly, the sovereignty of God has been a divisive truth sometimes to some people when it's there for our encouragement and our hope. I really think it's vital for you to get a handle on the doctrine of the sovereignty of God if you're going to stand in days and during circumstances that are liable to overwhelm you. There's really no other way. Are you going to stand there on your own strength? I don't know. I would encourage you that God is sovereign. God is sovereign over your circumstances. Let's read on. We'll see what God promises to do. We read on in the second section of our study here. We can see David's conviction about the sovereignty of God, and we can understand that. But it's clear that a second element kind of emerges here, and David's voice takes a tone that we're not very comfortable with. Verse 9, "Destroy, O Lord, divide their tongues." Verse 15, "Let death steal over them, let them go down to Sheol alive. For evil is in their dwelling place and in their heart." So what are we to make of this? In David's life, has his depression and distress turned to anger? I read a story that I thought was fascinating. Counselors over the centuries have discovered that some symptoms of depression disappear with overt expressions of anger. There was a 19th century physician in London, all right, 19th century. His name was Dr. Williams. I don't guess they gave his first name because they didn't want us persecuting his family. But he was consulted often by patients suffering from depression. And sometimes he would refer them to an eminent specialist who lived in Scotland. So these patients would make the journey. It would take several days by coach. And when they arrived there in Scotland, they found out that there was no such person. He had made it up. So he sent them on a 3 or 4 day trip by coach to Scotland to consult with a doctor who did not exist. So you can imagine the return trip and the anger that began to well up. And then when they would get back, they would vent their anger on Dr. Williams, and so he would say they came home furious, but no longer depressed. And that was his treatment. Is that what's going on with David? Is he just getting it off his chest? Is he venting his spleen against somebody? It may be tempting to read the psalm that way. Or maybe even in our righteousness we say, how far short these Old Testament people come from the teachings of Jesus in the New Testament, where we're told to love your enemies. And Paul even said this in Romans chapter 12, "To the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink, for by doing so you will heap burning coals on his head." And we like that last part. Burning coals on their head, that sounds right. I mean, they're an enemy. And we think, gosh, the New Testament people were just so much more righteous than the Old Testament people, until we realize that both Jesus and Paul were expounding on Old Testament truth. Proverbs Chapter 25, see if this sounds familiar. This is verse 21. If your enemy is hungry, give him bread to eat. And if he is thirsty, give him water to drink. For you will heap burning coals on his head, and the Lord will reward you. All right. So that is in the Old Testament. So is David sinning here? That would be a really neat package for us to wrap up this whole passage into, if it was true. But I don't think it was. Let me point out a couple of things. When he says, destroy, O Lord, divide their tongues, that in that passage, he's actually alluding back to Genesis chapter 11. In Genesis chapter 11, verse 7 and verse 9, we read, this is God speaking, come, let us go down there and confuse their language. Therefore, its name was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth. You remember the story, right? Mankind decided, we're going to build a pro-man, anti-God monument, a ziggurat, to display our glory, man's glory. Because that, after all, is more meaningful than God's glory. And God was going to have no part of that. And so as we read there in Genesis chapter 11, he confused their language. The same thing as dividing their tongue or dividing their speech. So David is praying that God would confuse their speech or ruin their plans. In 2 Samuel 15, remember I alluded to this earlier. Okay, thank you, John. Where was I? Oh, in 2 Samuel 15, David is actually going through this time of the betrayal by Ahithophel. We see Absalom's revolt, and you can read on until you get to verse 31. And it was told David, Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. And David said, O Lord, please turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness. Very similar to divide their tongues, confuse their speech, ruin their plans, turn his counsel into foolishness. John Calvin says in his commentary that he means in general to pray that God would break their criminal confederacies and distract their impious counsels. It is thus that to this day, he, being God, weakens the enemies of the church and splits them into factions through the force of mutual animosities, rivalries, and disagreements in opinion. So that's what David is longing for. You've got these people, God, who are against me. Confuse their plans. Then David goes further and says, let death steal over them. Let them go down to Sheol alive, for evil is in their dwelling place. That's pretty harsh. No matter who has betrayed you and how close they were, no matter what girlfriend broke up with you or boyfriend left you, praying that they go down to Sheol alive is pretty severe. But this again refers to an Old Testament story that his readers would have been familiar with, and that is in the book of Numbers, chapter 16. We talked a little about this in one of the previous Psalms, but this is the story of Korah and his rebellion against God's anointed. Remember that this coup by Absalom was against God's anointed king, God's ruler of his people, David. Here in Numbers, we also have an uprising against God's anointed. That man was Moses. And Korah and his followers said that, Moses, you've gone too far. You've exalted yourself and you've made yourself a prince over the rest of the people. And this angered Moses. If you read the passage, it would anger me too. You can disagree with me, but to accuse me of making myself a prince, that's a little beyond what I'm comfortable with tolerating. Moses was too. He was angry. And apparently so was God, because God told Moses, get away, separate yourself from Korah, so that I may consume him. So Moses told all the people, get away from Korah and his men. And they did. And then we read in Numbers 16, verse 31, and as soon as he had finished speaking all of these words, the ground under them split apart, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up with their households, and all the people who belonged to Korah and all their goods. So they and all that belonged to them went down alive into Sheol, and the earth was closed over them, and they perished from the midst of the assembly. So here in both cases, David is simply praying, God, do what you've already done before. This is a similar situation, God. Your glory is at stake. Confuse their plans. These people have risen up against God's anointed leader. Do what you did to Korah. Just do it again. Because in this Psalms and others where we see these kind of prayers, we need to remember that this is not David praying in personal vindictiveness. He's not defending himself against personal attack, but he realizes that this is an attack upon the kingdom of God. The kingdom of God who on earth is to be led by him, David. We see this same thing referred to in Psalm chapter 2. Because you wonder, well, who is David talking about? Who are these people? Well, Psalm chapter 2 describes them not in great detail, but generally. And it kind of has a parallel application to both God's ruler on the earth at the time and his son, Jesus, who will come later. It says, why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us. Let's get rid of the rules God puts on us. Let's get rid of his limitations on our speech, on our actions, our behavior, on our marriages, on the way we do church. Let's get rid of it. Verse 4, he who sits in the heaven laughs. The Lord holds them in derision. Then he will speak to them in his wrath and terrify them in his fury, saying, as for me, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill. I just imagine, did David write that? It doesn't say. I can imagine David has got that in his mind. God, these people have set themselves against your kingdom. And he holds them in derision, just like that verse says that God does. Even the book of Revelation portrays the saints in heaven crying out for God's judgment on the earth. In Revelation chapter 6, verse 10, it says, they cried out with a loud voice, O sovereign Lord, holy and true, how long before you will judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth? I think the saints in heaven recognize that there is such a thing as the wrath of the Lamb. Revelation 6:16 deals with that. The enemies of the Lamb are righteously condemned and overthrown. I think there's even a sense we pray for this when we say, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. So there's a righteous instinct in David here, I believe, and it may be the beginning of his recovery. He believes that God can do something about the situation. He's concerned about God's glory, not just his own difficulties. And he has really regained his assurance that justice will be served. So we move from David's fury to the third part, which is David's faith. Because there is a development. Earlier in the psalm, I think we see David wanting immediate divine intervention. Divide their tongues and let death steal over them, verses 9 and verse 15. Later, I believe we see, still in the context of divine judgment, a different tone. In verse 19, God will give ear and humble them, he who is enthroned from of old. And verse 23, but you, O God, will cast them down. See, I think early on, David may have been impatient with God, the very God who is so patient with us. He may have forgotten his own sinfulness. We don't know. We're just speculating here. I mean, who is David to complain about someone betraying him? I could see that section of Psalm 55 being written by Uriah the Hittite, whom David betrayed and had murdered. So, I don't know, maybe David has a work of grace going on in his own life where he begins to see this conflict not merely as a personal attack, a personal vendetta maybe, but he sees it as spiritual warfare. And as such, he knows that he cannot just fly away on the wings of a dove, but he needs to equip himself and stand, put on the armor of God, which is in Ephesians chapter 6. Maybe also he sees how he begins, or he begins to see how he is in need of God's grace and God's mercy. And in so thinking, his courage is really awakened, and his desire to leave gives way to something else. He figures out that the wings of a dove are a poor substitute for trust in the Lord. And we get to verse 22. This is really the verse that gives us the answer to the problem. And this is the verse that is quoted most often when people refer to this psalm. Verse 22 says, cast your burden on the Lord and he will sustain you. He will never permit the righteous to be moved. Now, when we see burden there, what that really means is what the Lord has placed on your shoulders. So cast on to the Lord what the Lord has placed on your shoulders. Remember, we believe that God is sovereign in this. He refers to him as God who is enthroned of old in verse 19. He is able to supply all the help that we need to live in the circumstances that he sets before us. We see a similar situation, I believe, in 1 Samuel chapter 1 with Hannah. Let me read the verses and then we'll give a little background. Verses 10 and 11 of 1 Samuel chapter 1, it says, she was deeply distressed and prayed to the Lord and wept bitterly. And she vowed a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your servant and remember me and not forget your servant, but will give to your servant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life and no razor shall touch her head. Now, just a little background on where that prayer comes from. If you remember, Hannah was barren, but her rival, Elkanah's other wife, Peninnah, if that's how you say it, something like that, it says in 1 Samuel 1, verse 6, used to provoke her grievously to irritate her because the Lord had closed her womb. And so it went on year by year. It even goes on to say that Hannah wouldn't eat and she would weep constantly. And that leads us to the prayer she prayed in verse 10. So here's a woman, she's the favorite wife, but she cannot have children. A young woman who desperately wants to have kids and cannot. That's bad enough. But you add to that the rival wife taunting her constantly. It says year after year. And when she prayed to God, it says that she wept bitterly. Man, I can see that. I can sense that. Whenever you are challenged, whether it be betrayal or slandered or tormented like Hannah was, the bitterness can grow so quickly. And so David's words were, cast your burden upon the Lord. Hannah did that, and it says she wept bitterly before the Lord. You could almost say she cast all of her bitterness onto the Lord as well. I think both of those can be highly instructive to us. That both are necessary. Not only do we actually cast what's bothering us onto God, the situation we're in, but we let him have the anger and the bitterness and the disappointment that goes along with it. Because that'll eat at you if you don't. Now, when David says, cast your burdens on the Lord, he doesn't say, and he will take away your circumstances. What he does say is that he will sustain you. The difference is as important as it is obvious. There were still enemies. David still lived in the city. There was still betrayal. The difference is that David finally realized that the Lord was there too. In verse 22, he says, he will never permit the righteous to be moved. In the New Testament, Peter says it another way. In 1 Peter 5, 7, he says, casting all of your anxieties on him because he cares for you. So the basis for us doing this as Christians is the care and loving kindness of God himself. Cast your anxieties upon him, for he cares for you. I'm going to ask Rob and Josh to come on down, please. Can you believe that? When you feel surrounded by enemies of all kinds, when you feel betrayed, when all you want to do is fly away, give up, or maybe when you're weeping bitterly, can you say, like David did in verse 23, but I will trust in you? Can you? Can I really say that to a God when I don't think he understands what I'm going through? Well, the truth is he does. He's come to us in the person of Jesus Christ who understands perfectly what you're going through. He knew what it was to live within the city, the evil, the fraud, all the other things that went with it. When he came, he was surrounded by his enemies. His soul was overcome with grief. Jesus knew what it was like for a close companion to betray him. In Gethsemane, he longed there that night that there might be some other way. But he cast his cares on the Lord. Not my will, but your will be done, were his words in the garden. And the Lord sustained him. When you know that, then you can say, along with David, but I will trust in you. Would you bow your heads? I want to take just a minute for you to think, are you in a situation like this? Maybe you feel betrayed by someone. Maybe you've been slandered. Or maybe you just feel like you're in a situation where you just want out. You wish you had the wings of a dove. So during this time when our guys are just going to play quietly, I would encourage you to go to God just like David did, just like Hannah did. Take your burdens, cast them upon God. And he will sustain you. Take just a few minutes to do that.